Go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/online-therapy to get 20% off your first month of cognitive behavioural therapy, with weekly sessions online with a therapist, in addition to worksheets, a journal, meditation and yoga videos, and unlimited messaging. There's strong evidence that CBT can help people who hoard, and accessing therapy online can be affordable and accessible. Find out more and get your discount at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/online-therapy.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Say hello to a new era of mental health care. Cerebral is here to help you achieve your mental wellness goals with professional therapy and medication management support. 100% online. You'll experience the all-new Cerebral way, an innovative approach to mental wellness designed around you. You'll get a personalized treatment plan from a therapist, prescriber, or both in a safe and judgment-free space. Your Cerebral therapist or prescriber will outline a customized plan with clear milestones along the way, so you can get to feeling your best. With Cerebral, you're not alone in your mental health journey. We're here to empower you to live a fulfilling life. So take that first step towards a brighter future and sign up today at Cerebral.com/podcast and use code ACAST to get 15% off your first month. Offer only valid on monthly plans. Other exclusions may apply. Offer ends July 31st, 2024. See site for details.
Welcome to the Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with That Hoarder podcast. I am drowning in stuff and trying to find a way out. Listen as I explore the issues and delve deep as somebody profoundly affected by hoarding disorder. Find out more, including links to subscribe to the podcast and all of my social media at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk. Finally, I am not a doctor. I am just a hoarder doing her best. So do seek professional support if and when you need it. So I am here with Professor Luna Dolezal, an associate professor in philosophy and medical humanities at the University of Exeter. She is the principal investigator on the Shame and Medicine Project and principal investigator on the Scenes of Shame and Stigma in COVID-19 Project. She co-authored a book, COVID-19 and Shame, which led to the Shame and the Pandemic podcast, which is where I first came across her. She also co-created an award-winning 10-part documentary series, Shame in Medicine, The Lost Forest, and is co-founder of the Shame Space. So you can see, given how obsessed I am with hoarding and shame, why I invited her on, and I was thrilled that she said yes. Luna, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for having me on. It's really nice to be here chatting with you about shame, my favorite topic, as you can see.
So shame is a really significant problem for people who hoard. It stops a lot of us from asking for help, whether from professionals or friends, and it feeds self-hatred, self-recrimination. So how did you first develop this focus on shame?
It's quite a long story. And the sort of short answer is that I have lived with chronic shame my whole life. And when I studied philosophy at university and then did a master's, when it came to do a master's dissertation, I somehow got to the topic of shame, not because I recognized that I was living with chronic shame, but because I guess I just somehow instinctively knew that that was something I needed to work through. And I wrote my PhD thesis about shame and the body. And what I was really interested in as a philosopher was phenomenology, which is a type of philosophy that is concerned with first person lived experience. And I was really interested in understanding like the phenomenology of embodiment. And how there were also theories about how our bodies are written by social forces. So like Foucault would be a kind of key thinker in that, where he talks about the disciplined body and the socially shaped body. And I was kind of like, how can we have these two accounts of what it means to be a human body? One that's like, you've got agency and freedom in the world. And the other is like, you're constrained and disciplined by the world. And I tried, so my thesis was like reconciling these two competing philosophical accounts of the body. And what I came to was shame was the thing that connected them. So shame is something that we experience in the first person perspective through our bodies. It's an embodied, really visceral emotion. But shame is very interesting because it's an emotion that baked into shame and folded into shame are social and political norms. So all of the rules of our societies, all of the mores, the norms, the standards, what's appropriate, what's not appropriate, what's valued, what's not valued, all of those are in shame. So when we experience shame, what we're also experiencing are those norms and the boundaries of what's acceptable or not acceptable in our society. So in every experience of shame, we are kind of learning what our society expects from us, and that shapes us. So we do everything we can to avoid shame because it's a really unpleasant experience. And through shame avoidance, we conform to what's expected. And so I just became like so fascinated by this, because it's like, we all know what shame is insofar as like we've all experienced it, or we can kind of point to experiences we've had of it, but not many of us really understand this aspect of shame, that it is about training us, socializing us to fit in, because as animals, we need to survive, and we're herd animals. We live in groups and we need groups to survive. We need to be cared for. You know, in infancy and in childhood, we need to be cared for by others. And so we learn very quickly how to behave in a way that means that people keep caring for us, looking after us, feeding us, helping us grow. So yeah, shame is like central to all of that. And once you start to see that, you're like, wow, shame is the thing that's like, you know, it's making the whole show possible, really. Actually, it's the thing that keeps social cohesion, keeps communities in harmony, social harmony. So yeah, like, I'm talking about it so cheerfully, but it's such a negative experience. But like, it's so interesting. Once you see that, it's like, wow, you see it everywhere.
Yeah, it is. I think it helps to start with being really clear exactly what we're talking about. I feel like we know shame when we feel it, but I'd struggle to describe it. So what would you say shame is?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think a lot of people would struggle to define shame and kind of name it precisely. So to me, shame is, it's a type of emotion or affect, and it's usually called a negative self-conscious emotion. So what that means is that in every shame experience, we have an experience of self-consciousness, which means we have the sense or feeling that we can see ourselves from another person's perspective, and that other person, and that could be a real person, or it could be like an internalized person, or it could be something like God, like an ideal person. That person is judging us negatively. So if I see shame as a kind of umbrella term that captures a whole range of experiences where we feel that we are being judged negatively by another person or a group, or even by like an internal standard that we hold, and that negative judgment will compromise our sense of belonging and connection. So what that means is, we worry, shame is an experience where we worry that we're going to be negatively judged or seen to be worth less than others. So it might be that negative judgment is just simply like you're not valued as much as others. And that as a result of that, we might be rejected or not liked or ostracized or kicked out of the social group. So that's what I see shame. And that, for me, it's like shame is an umbrella term that covers a whole range of experiences. So it could be things like embarrassment or humiliation or mortification. Those are kind of cognate emotions that we would recognize as shame emotions. But then experiences like being disrespected, being ridiculed, being put down, being made to feel like you're not worth as much as others. So there's a whole range of experiences where you have this negative self-conscious experience where you feel like others are judging you in a particular way. That means that you're being marginalized or rejected or kind of put into the out group rather than being in the in group. So it's a huge terrain of experiences as far as I'm concerned. And like, I'm a philosopher, and in philosophy of emotion, there's a big big area of research to try and like precisely define these emotion terms. So how is shame different from guilt? How is shame different from embarrassment? And I just think, I don't think there's any point. I mean, it's interesting, kind of intellectually interesting, but I think when we're thinking about how we actually experience these emotions, it can be very blurry and a lot of overlapping experiences. You can feel embarrassed and guilty at the same time, or embarrassed and shamed at the same time, or you can live with different types of shame that mean, you know, they're experienced very differently in different contexts. So it's a very mercurial, changeable experience.
So what is the impact on people who feel profound shame?
That's a really good question. So shame, I think, so first I should start with saying like shame is not necessarily a negative emotion. So like as I was discussing earlier, shame plays this really important role in our society, in our social development, and in kind of families and in communities, insofar as it's like a warning signal that tells you that you have done something, or you are something, or there's something happening that might compromise your sense of being part of a group. It might mean that you might be rejected from a group because you're violating the norms or standards of that group. So it's called a pro-social emotion, insofar as it's pro-social because it facilitates us having harmonious social relationships. The problem is that sometimes the norms and standards of our group can be unjust or unfair. And so you might start to feel shame when there's no reason for you to feel shame. You haven't done something abhorrent or terrible, like murder someone. But like if you're a woman, it could be that you're being shamed, or you feel shame because you don't conform to certain like really narrow standards of beauty and attractiveness, which is totally unfair because there's nothing shameful about, you know, not being super skinny and super beautiful. But that, so shame can act as like something that helps you fit into your social group, but it can also become something that can be personally damaging and destructive if the norms by which you're feeling shame are not fair or unjust or disadvantage you in some way. And like, we just have to think about like racism, you know, like where there are these white supremacist norms, where it's like, by white supremacy, I mean like the white race is better. So white beauty norms, white, you know, so then anyone who has a different complexion then is disadvantaged automatically because of the dominant norms. So what shame can make us feel is that there's something, it's a very isolating emotion. So it can make us feel like that there's something wrong with us, that we're flawed or at fault. And then the kind of, I think the natural reaction is to want to kind of withdraw or hide. Like when you think about what I would call the phenomenology of shame, which is like how we have the lived experience of the first person experience of shame. If you have like a really intense shame episode, so like say I was giving a lecture in front of a big lecture theater and like my shirt fell off or something and I didn't have a bra on, I mean, obviously I'd be mortified. And that would be an acute shame, an acute shame episode. And probably I would feel like flushed and like I wanted to sink into the ground. I'd probably like try and cover my body and my face, like I'd want to hide. So we can see this sort of physical manifestations of shame paralleled in the way we experience it socially. So we might want to withdraw. We might not want to talk to people. We might want to keep things secret. We might want to hide. So then there's this kind of retreating that can happen when we experience shame. Then that goes along with the kind of negative affects, so like the pain, the anxiety, the fear, maybe the horror, and that also goes along, yeah, with the sense of not being good enough, like feeling that others are judging you, that they might, you know, they might know that you're a terrible person, you know, this kind of like in the theater of your mind, everyone's thinking about you and saying you're a terrible person, you know. And I think we've all experienced that shame. These really intense shame episodes, they like burn brightest in your memory, right? You can like think back to childhood and they all stand out. And because the emotion is so intense and often really painful, it's like it attaches to that memory. So that memory stays very bright and the other ones recede. It's like your most memorable things are when you have those heightened emotional states, right? And shame is one of those. And it's like your psyche telling you don't do that again, because that was the thing that almost got you rejected. So it's super interesting when you start to unpack it, and how actually shame is an emotion that's there to protect us and to help us survive, but it's so easily distorted into something that can become isolating, damaging, limiting, you know.
Yeah, and it's interesting from obviously from the hoarding point of view, but also like when I was a kid and realizing I was gay in a world that that was not okay in.
Yeah.
The shame I felt like was some kind of inherent to me thing. And now, of course, looking back, I see that that was what the world was putting on me.
Yeah.
But at the time, my understanding of it was I am wrong and this is shameful.
Definitely. And I think one of the most profoundly empowering things that you can know about shame is that when you experience shame, it could be that you've done something wrong, but it might also be that there's something wrong in the world, that the norms in the world are wrong and there's nothing wrong with you. And I think once you realize that, it can really, you just, you know, you need to kind of work that out for yourself, because sometimes we do things that mean we should feel shame, or we might, you know, but that often it's that there's something wrong in the world. There's some norm or expectation or standard that is not fair, and it needs to be changed, actually. And I think precisely like that, you know, thinking about racism or homophobia or all of these ableism or all of these things, that's the kind of work, is to try and change the standards and norms.
Yeah, absolutely. And that leads on nicely to my next question, actually, which is that people do have these different intersecting identities. We might be disabled, we might be gay, we might live in poverty, we might belong to a minority religion. Does this have an effect on how we experience shame and on the impact it has?
I think so, yes. And I think there is evidence to support this. But I think if you're already living with an identity that's disadvantaged or minoritized, or already living in a way where you're incurring like negative, anticipating or actually incurring negative judgment from others because you're not fitting into the dominant normative structures that of your society, then you're more vulnerable to shame and more vulnerable to the negative effects of shame. So I think it's like, yeah, there's a sense of like, you don't have the kind of robust resources to resist shame. And I think shame is always connected to social power. So those who have more power and privilege are kind of more resilient to shame, because it's like, you feel shame and then it's like, oh, well, I must have done something wrong. I've learned my lesson and carry on with your life. If you're someone who's already disadvantaged or disempowered or minoritized, the shame could just be this thing to confirm to you that you are actually worth less than others because of, you know, this is the message you've been receiving over and over and over again. And if you're living with racism and every time you have an interaction, you're anticipating that some sort of aggression or microaggression or some sort of, you know, so then you come to anticipate this, and that it, you know, it certainly does have an effect. And you know, experiences of chronic shame are really strongly correlated to trauma. So living as a trauma survivor, having experienced trauma in childhood, really strongly correlated to poverty and social deprivation. So living in a way that you're like chronically disadvantaged and minoritized and marginalized. And then things like, yeah, sexism, racism, you know, forms of discrimination, living with stigma, certainly.
What is the difference between shame and stigma?
This is such a good question. So I think they're different. Well, they are different. So stigma is a kind of category term. So we talk about someone having a stigma, but stigma isn't something that you experience directly. So if you read research about people experiencing stigma, what you usually find is what people are talking about are the kind of phenomena associated with stigma. So that would be things like labeling or stereotyping or marginalization, discrimination, being treated unfairly. So we don't experience stigma. We experience all those other things. And I see shame as a kind of emotional component of that. So if you want to understand what living with stigma is like, it's kind of an anticipation of being negatively judged by others and therefore being treated differently for some, you know, in some way, whether that's being, you know, actually like discriminated against or being shouted at or whatever it could be. But so shame is an experience, where stigma is a kind of a label for a type of way of being in the world. So what's interesting, and this is I had a research project about shame in COVID, and there was a lot of writing about stigma in COVID at the very beginning. COVID obviously is an infectious illness, and it's contagious and highly transmissible. So there was already the stigma of being infected or potentially, and it was something that like all the global public health bodies like CDC and WHO and Public Health England immediately were on it. So they were writing loads about putting out public health stuff about stigma, but no one was talking about shame. And this was really interesting because while I think it's reasonable to say that all stigma has shame as potentially as an experiential part of it. So if you live with a stigmatized condition, you might anticipate shame or you might experience shame. But not all shame is about stigma. So there was a lot of shame that happened during the pandemic that had nothing to do with stigmatized identities or stigmatized conditions, you know, like the pandemic shaming, like neighbors being shamed for not clapping on their doorsteps on Thursday night. That was nothing to do with stigma. Yeah. There's all this shame circulating during the pandemic that wasn't about stigma and about the stigma of infectious illness. So they're related, but they're also separate. And there's certainly a lot of shame that can be experienced that's not related to stigma. And I think when there's a big focus in health and public health on stigma, then those other experiences don't get attention. You know, someone like who doesn't have any kind of stigmatized condition or identity and lives with relative privilege could still be like completely disabled by shame, you know, might have for whatever reason experiences of shame that mean that they don't access healthcare or I think both things need to be considered.
Yeah. Do you have any burning questions you'd love me to answer? My first Q&A episode was really popular, and so I'm open now to more questions. Contact me on Twitter, Facebook, TikTok, Reddit, YouTube, or plain old email. All the links are on my website at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk. Ask me anything and I'll do my best to answer. I'm really interested in the difference between shame being kind of innate or feeling innate and shame from others. So yeah. How does it work when we are shamed compared to when we feel like it's coming from within ourselves? Can it come from within ourselves with no external input?
I think that's a good question. I mean, I think shame always has external input because the things we feel shame about are measured against norms that we didn't create. We are born into societies that have norms and standards and, you know, already have values that tell you what's good or bad or appropriate or inappropriate. So those we don't create ourselves. They're collectively made, and it's really hard to point to who made them, but they're collectively generated and we are enmeshed in them. So those are always part of shame. So we need some sort of standard. But certainly I think it's the case that we can internalize a set of standards. So when I feel shame, it could be that like there's a flesh and blood person in front of me who's I can see is looking at me and judging me. And then I feel the flush of shame because I see that negative judgment. But it could be that I do something like nobody sees me, but I steal something from a shop. Nobody's seen me do it, but I still feel shame because I've got like my mom in my head, sort of like internalized her standards or her what she would do or think is bad. Or something like God or some other. So I think we can internalize norms and ideals and values that mean we can then start to shame ourselves. And like, honestly, usually they come from our family. So we inherit them from our family, which is the most like influential place where we develop who we are, is our how we kind of grow up, our caregivers in childhood. And that could be like an immediate family, or it could be loads of different caregivers, but that is the environment where we get these standards, and that they become really hard to change. So we can change them. But yeah, I think it's really interesting because I often think about like the liberation movement. So I think about like gay pride or like Black is Beautiful or these political movements that try and change shame into pride, which is super important. And like taking something that's like previously been hidden and taboo and secret and putting it out and being proud. And I think that is really important, but I don't think those liberation movements will take away the shame that individuals feel. So you might be part of a liberation, you know, liberation politics and be out and proud with your community, but you still might then just be at home feeling ashamed of yourself, even though you've done all this cognitive work to talk yourself out of the shame. It stays with you. And I'm talking from experience living with chronic shame, no matter how brilliant I think I am on one level. On the other level, I think I am worthless, you know. So, and like, I can hold those two things in my head at the same time. Yeah. And negotiate them, but I'm never going to get rid of my shame. I know that.
Like, how many survivors of sexual violence do you hear say, like, the victim's never to blame, and they believe that, but then, except me, I was to blame. Nobody else is to blame. So there's like a principle that there should be no shame, but it's like an exception in your own case.
Yeah. And I think it's really important to have those messages and, like, you know, totally, you need to hear those messages because that's so important. But I think it's like shifting your own. You have to have it all. Yeah, you have to have it all at once. I think understand that it's really hard to take away feelings of shame, but you can certainly work on them and understand them and recognize them. When I feel shame, I recognize it and have curiosity about it. Still feel the emotions of it, but I'm much more. I mean, I've been working on it as an academic, so very very curious about it, but. It's something that can stay with you a long time, I think, yeah.
Can shame ever be positive? Can we shame ourselves into taking action, or can we be shamed into taking positive action?
I think so. I would never recommend that shame is used intentionally as a tool for behavior change. So like for public health or other like criminal justice, I think that when it's kind of institutionalized or made formal, I think it will always backfire. But I think shame does, I think it's undoubtedly, there's evidence that it has a positive effect sometimes. So like if you have, like for instance, a public health campaign that's about shaming people out of smoking, it might work for like 100 people, it might work for 5 of them. And they might go, yeah, actually, the shame has taught me a lesson and I realize I need to have some positive change. And the other 95 might just feel the shame just makes them feel bad about themselves and further entrenches the negative behavior and the negative patterns of thought and actually maybe even exacerbates. And there's evidence around this, around obesity campaigns that use shame and stigma, that it actually just makes the problem worse, or if you want to call it a problem, you know, it just exacerbates the kinds of things that you're trying to change. So I do think I think we can. I mean, I can think of my own experiences where I've experienced shame and learned something and changed, but I've also experienced the opposite, which is like I've felt shame and it's made me withdraw or avoid rather than take proactive positive steps to do something. So it's very volatile. We never know how it's going to land, and you can shame, you know, 100 people, sort of throw the same shame at them or have the same shame campaign or shaming action, and they might all react differently. It depends on circumstances, context, you know, your history, your personal history. If you've experienced trauma, you know, if you've experienced other forms of minoritization or marginalization, it's really hard to predict the effect it would have on people.
Now, you wrote a paper on trauma and shame, and a significant number of people who hoard have experienced trauma, if not all, really. So this was a quote by Lucia Osborne Crowley. Yeah. And it says, trauma leads to shame. Trauma determines the content of shame. Shame pushes the body into a traumatic response. The more I learn about the two, the more I am convinced of their deep connection to one another. So what first alerted you to that connection between trauma and shame?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. I live in Exeter, which is in Devon, and another city in Devon is Plymouth. And I was invited by the Trauma-Informed Plymouth Network to give a talk. And so I thought I'll give the talk on shame and trauma and kind of research the links between them. And they are the Plymouth Trauma Network is amazing. It's a network of hundreds of practitioners, and their aim is to make Plymouth a trauma-informed city. So they run trainings and do a lot of work to get people who work in professional or in like human services or care professions trained in trauma-informed approaches. So I've learned a lot working with them, and I kind of through them was kind of started doing research about what is the trauma-informed approach, I've not done the training, but what are people trained to recognize and understand? And you're probably familiar with it, but the idea is that if you recognize that people who are accessing your services have probably experienced trauma, then that you need to be conscious of how you're delivering your services, because you don't want to re-traumatize them. And what I found really interesting was that, like, shame is not part of the trauma-informed approach. And that's kind of the paper that you read. So that became really interesting to me, because I had already been doing work in medicine, looking at how shame is sort of a potent treatment barrier. So if you experience shame, and that could be health-related shame, so you feel shame about the condition you have. So you've got a certain type of cancer that is taboo, like cervical cancer, bowel cancer. So you're too embarrassed to go to the doctor because they might have to examine your private parts, or you feel like it's a lifestyle thing. It's your fault that you have the condition. So then you feel ashamed. So
HIV or...
Yeah, exactly. Infectious illness, lung cancer and HIV and obesity, you know, things like that, where it's like it's perceived to be your own fault that you haven't looked after yourself properly. You've done something taboo or deviant to get to that place. And so there's evidence that shame can... we only have to think of that TV show Embarrassing Bodies to know this. Like, people are too embarrassed to go to the doctor, so they go on TV instead. It's like, I just can't believe that show, but it works. But it's like shame can make people avoid seeking help even when they're concerned about a condition. It can mean that they don't follow through with appointments, they don't follow through with treatments, they conceal their diagnoses from friends and family, and so on. So it really concretely impact on negative health outcomes or make people sicker. And also, it's not just shame about medical conditions, but also shame about anything like poverty, low literacy, your sexual orientation, gender identity. These things that aren't to do with your health can nonetheless keep you from seeking help because you're afraid of being judged negatively. So it seemed like in the medical realm, it's like, this is really clear that shame is the treatment barrier. And so then, like, it seemed really clear to me that for trauma, that's sure, it's like the trauma that people have experienced is certainly part of the background. But if you want to understand how people are interacting in a like consultation, what are the emotions and the forces going on in the room, looking at shame seemed completely central. And there's evidence that people who've experienced trauma live with chronic shame a lot of the time. And then there's shame related to all sorts of things, like, well, first of all, like the shame of being a trauma survivor, the label of having experienced trauma, that's stigmatizing and can feel shaming. You might be ashamed of the trauma that happened to you, especially if it's something related to childhood abuse or childhood sexual abuse or violence, you know, the shame of being a victim. There's all this shame you don't want people to know because they might think you're damaged or defiled. You know, there's all these. So shame seems so obviously like important. So that's how I kind of got to looking into the connections between shame and trauma. And there's a bit of literature, like starting to think about, there's one paper by someone called Taylor who says, it's called Have We Failed to See the Obvious? And she's talking about shame as being the key thing that people experience when they're living in post-trauma states. So like, you talk about all these other things that happen after trauma, but shame is the, if you want to understand what you need to change in services, then looking at shame is the key thing that people are probably living with and is affecting the decisions they make, affecting their behavior and affecting how they connect with other people or don't connect. It seems, so there is this kind of evidence, like there's another couple of papers that talk about PTSD as shame disorders or as a shame disorder. So you can, like the behaviors, the common behaviors that come out of these more intense post-trauma states are really like similar to the behaviors that we exhibit when we're living with shame. So then, you know, if you can start to think through those different experiences, and it's really getting at it from like the first, this, like, I'm a philosopher of phenomenology, so the first person lived experience, so what are people actually experiencing? Then you it starts to become kind of obvious, I think. Yeah.
Normally being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra.
and UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
And I feel like from what you're saying, these things multiply as well. So you feel, you experience trauma and you feel shame about that. And then maybe in reaction to your trauma, you self-harm or you start hoarding or something and you feel shame about that. And then you can't get help for the mental health consequences because that would mean admitting the original shame. Yeah. So things get worse. And I feel like it's just multiplies in a big bundle.
I completely agree. And I think there's shame about trauma, then there's shame about the coping behaviors that you use to deal with the trauma, and then there's like the wanting to hide all of that, and the shame about, there's also the shame about the shame, because shame is shameful and taboo, so you feel like bad about feeling shame, because that shame in our society, in our cultural context, especially for men, shame is weakness, it's vulnerability, it's failure, it connotes all of these things. So even admitting that you feel shame is shaming, and it's intolerable for a lot of people, especially men. You know, I don't want to generalize about genders, but I think there is evidence that it's actually just harder to have that kind of emotional vulnerability. And like one of the most, Brené Brown, who's popularized shame through her research and vulnerability, I think she's absolutely right that one of the most, she says shame cannot survive being spoken. So one of the most useful things to like cope with your own shame or process or metabolize your own shame is to just talk about it with others. Like, and it's finding that safe community of others. And it's probably going to be people who've had experiences like you or live in a way that, you know, that you can, that they can understand you in a deep way, empathize, you know, understand and relate, and just being open about the shame. That piece is really important, the shame, you know, because then it helps just evaporate it a bit. I speak really openly about my shame. It doesn't make it go away, but it does like make me have more power over it. So it's not disempowering me to the same extent that it used to. And I recognize more the sorts of things it, can make me do, because shame is this powerful, powerful driver of behavior and decision making. So we make our decisions to avoid shame. So I won't go to that party, or I won't go give that talk, or I won't go do this because I don't want to be vulnerable to a shameful exposure in whatever way I imagine it could happen. And once we understand that the decision making is being driven by this fear of shameful exposure, the anticipation of shame, then you can start, you know, you can start to unpack it and kind of get a bit more power over it slowly.
Which leads perfectly to my next question. Your paper about shame and trauma talks about the problems of shame avoidance and shame anticipation. So can you explain those ideas first of all?
Yeah, definitely. So I've been very like intellectually and personally interested in the experience of chronic shame. So there, I think like it's useful to sort of think about, there's lots of different types of ways we can experience shame, but there's sort of two big categories that are useful to understand, which is like acute shame or like a shame episode. Like I described, like I'm standing in front of a talk and then I realize I'm naked and I'm like humiliated in that moment. And that's a shame episode, which is related to a discrete event. I have this emotional reaction, which kind of arises, has a certain duration, and then passes away. And we call that acute shame. And those are those things that you like remember. They burn brightest in your memory. You never forget those moments. And you might keep them secret, you know, your whole life. You might, something happened in childhood, you never tell anyone your whole life. And then there's chronic shame, which is very, very different, which is where you live with a kind of, some people call it a shame disposition or dispositional shame or toxic shame, where you just feel this kind of pervasive feeling of inadequacy, and that like you're worth less than others, that you're flawed or wrong kind of all the time. And it can become like more acute at certain points. What you live with isn't shame. So you're not living in this kind of shame episode the whole time. What you're living with is a chronic anticipation of shame. So what you're living with is like a worry that you're going to be judged negatively, that just around the corner, someone's going to expose you. And so you live with shame anticipation. And what you, and there's this brilliant quote from Patricia DeYoung, which I quote her in the paper. It's something like, what you live with is not shame. What you live with is what you need to do to avoid falling into shame. So you might become, you get so good at shame avoidance that you actually may never experience shame. Yeah. You're just doing everything you can to avoid shame, right? So you don't go out, you don't talk to those certain people, you don't go to the doctor, you know, you do all these things. So you kind of like organize your whole life around shame avoidance. Patricia DeYoung's book is brilliant. It's one of the few books that's just about chronic shame. It's called Understanding and Treating Chronic Shame. She's a psychotherapist or psychotherapeutic analyst or something. I can't remember exactly what tradition, but she talks about how when she's working with clients, she might recognize that they're living with chronic shame. So they have this pattern of like, you know, negative and the anticipation of negative judgment from others, which is organizing everything they do. But because they never fall into shame, they're so good at avoiding it and organizing themselves around shame avoidance, they would themselves never identify shame as an issue in their lives. And she herself talks about how she might not name it for, she would understand that, but she might not name it to them. So it's like you become so good at avoiding shame, you kind of avoid yourself. You kind of avoid it to the point that you don't even realize that it's the thing driving your behavior. And I've talked to so many people who've like learned about this idea of chronic shame. And then it, once you see your, you look back at your life through the shame lens and you're like, oh, that's what was going on. Now I understand. And it's so useful as a way to kind of understand or make sense of, especially if you know you've experienced trauma or, you know, like it just becomes really, it just helps you understand what's kind of been going on for you. And yeah, I've personally found it really useful. And the idea of like shame avoidance is that something that can organize your world and your life, that you're organizing yourself around avoiding shame. And the thing is, like, you often just, I mean, like you start to anticipate shame where it's not there. So then you become so good at avoiding shame, you start thinking it's going to be everywhere. So it might not be the case that, you know, sometimes it is the case. If you're living with racism or discrimination of some sort, it probably is the case that when you come into contact with others, there's some sort of shaming happening, whether it's explicit or implicit. But for others, that might not be the case at all. People think you're brilliant, but you're still living with this like chronic anticipation that they're going to judge you badly. If they only knew, or if they find out, or if you say too much, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah. And so then it becomes this, like, you're limiting what's possible in your own life, not to put blame on anyone. But then if you start to understand that it's not the world that's shaming you, but that there's something inside you that's afraid of something in the world, that it can be really useful to help understand the things we do to cope, you know, that we need to do to cope.
Yeah. I know I had a period a while ago when I couldn't take rubbish out of the house because I thought if my neighbors saw me taking rubbish out, they would know I was a hoarder. because I had rubbish to take out. And so I couldn't let them see me take rubbish out. And it took me a while to realize, I think I knew it was irrational.
Yeah,
but it took me a while to realize that I was anticipating all kinds of things there, none of which were likely to happen.
Yeah.
But I was avoiding it just through that anticipation.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I completely relate to that, where you kind of anticipate things that you've kind of, that aren't like going to actually manifest in the world. And I think that's another, like what you've just said has just made me think, like, another really important point about shame is that because it's such a powerful emotion, we go to such great lengths to avoid it. It's shameful, it's taboo, but it's also really threatening to us because it's so painful, or can feel so painful. Losing our connections to others is like the most painful thing that can happen to us. Like when we lose people through death, like grief and shame are like these things that are so the really most painful emotions. And but so because of that, we will do anything to avoid shame. And that becomes like against our best judgment, against reason and rationality. You know, you will do crazy things to avoid shame, like not going to the doctor, even when you think you have cancer, you know, that kind of stuff. And that if anyone saw it from an outside perspective, it would look kind of nuts. But from an inside perspective, it's like, this is about my survival. You know, this is my survival. And that's why it seems perfectly, I'm not going to say it seems reasonable, but it seems like the right thing, because you're at that like primal level of survival. Of like, it's not about rationality or reason.
I read an article recently where a man was interviewed and he's got throat cancer that was sexually transmitted. It was HPV based. And he was basically saying that most people with that throat cancer won't tell people because it involves the implication of having of sexual activity.
A specific kind of sexual activity. Yes.
And but he was, you know, he was refusing to play along with that. It was ridiculous. He had cancer. This was how he got it. And he was now, you know, dealing with that fact. But because it's not like the, you mentioned cervical cancer earlier. That's a similar thing in that partly it's sort of it's that it's about a part of the body that is still kind of shameful to even reference. But it's also partly because it is often caused by HPV, which is sexually transmitted. And so there's layers, isn't there?
There's layers. And then like, if you think about the only way to discover you have cervical cancer is to go for a gynecological examination, which is like, no matter how robust you are, deeply humiliating. Like you have to lie on your back, you have to have your legs wide, you've got to think about your pubic hair, you know, like all this stuff.
Yeah.
And then it's often a man, you know, like there's a male doctor could be and like someone you've never met before. And there's so much vulnerability. And it's, you know, and a lot of women avoid it because of that. And if they've had any sort of negative experience around, you know, sexual violence, sexual abuse, anything, then of course you're going to avoid it, you know, even more. So it's so, so sensitive. And that's one of the things with our project around shame in medicine. It's like, making healthcare workers understand the power of shame. And I think in sexual health services, actually, there is a lot more open discussion about shame and stigma, but like how even, you know, as a doctor, you have a power and authority, you're the professional, and even like a tiny throwaway remark can be devastating for someone. You know, they'll never forget it.
People remember those for years, don't they?
Yeah, exactly. And you never forget it. And it might mean you never go back, you know, and it's like, and as the professional, you just think you're giving some good advice or something, or you're saying the right thing, or you know, and it's like, really understanding how it can land so differently because of the, obviously the power differential and the kind of, you know, the, thinking about how someone might be feeling in that moment. And like how, you just have to be so, so careful in these sensitive moments.
Yeah. So shame can prevent trauma survivors from accessing treatment. And it can prevent hoarders from accessing treatment as well. I think I resisted getting help for the longest time because of what I now, having read your paper, would understand as shame anticipation and shame avoidance. Is the shame that prevents trauma survivors, hoarders from accessing treatment, is that the same mechanism or might there be different things going on?
I think it would be really similar, like what you described there, just the shame avoidance. It's, we want to protect ourselves from shame because it's so painful and feels bad, basically. And we want to hide shame from others because shame is taboo. So there's all these layers of trying to protect yourself or oneself from shame. And I think it is really similar. I mean, and I think people who haven't experienced trauma, that pattern can still be there. The like, you know, I think it's universal. And I guess like getting onto the idea of principles for shame sensitive practice, like the paper that you're referring to, I wrote with a colleague called Matthew Gibson. He's a social worker, and he actually wrote a book about shame in social work practice and child and family social work. And he's the one who's like had this idea of, you know, let's make medicine shame sensitive. So the idea is like, if healthcare workers were taught about shame and its effects and how it, you know, like anecdotally, we all know, and there's that show Embarrassing Bodies, and we know shame can be something that keeps patients from accessing help. But if you start to really understand how shame dynamics circulate, so like if a doctor is feeling shame about something, like they don't know, like say they don't know something and they're feeling a bit ashamed of it. And one way we deal with our shame is by discharging it on others. And usually that shame rolls downhill. So you discharge it on someone with less power than you. So you might take it out on a medical student or on a patient, or, you know, once you start to see this, you can really start to see when someone feels insecure about something, they might lash out at someone else, or, you know, once you start to recognize these dynamics. But importantly, if you can recognize them in yourself, like what's the way you cope with shame, then you can start, if you're the professional who's supposed to help people, then you can start to, you know, understand. And the thing is, like, as a professional, if someone comes to you, there might be something about them that makes you feel shame. Like maybe they live in poverty or they have low literacy. That makes you feel ashamed. So, you know, because of the kind of empathy you have for them. And then that could lead to some sort of, you know, strange acting out on your part. So just having this out in the open and more transparent is really important. Like these emotional dynamics can really change the course of someone's life. If that means they never go back to the doctor, that can change everything, you know. So shame sensitive practice, the idea was to get away from just a trauma-informed approach, which is focusing on people who've experienced trauma or understanding that trauma might be something that could become a barrier to properly accessing services, and kind of broadening it out and going, actually, yes, of course trauma is going to have these effects and lead to social difficulties potentially for people. And there's all this evidence that correlates it to, like, you know, mental ill health and to all sorts of other things like being involved in the criminal justice system or homelessness. You know, there's loads of evidence about that, all of that. But shame is something that affects us all. And if all services were shame sensitive, it would help everyone. You know, it would help people who've experienced trauma. It would help people who don't, who haven't, and everyone, because even the most robust person could still be, you know, negatively impacted by shame and their desperate need to avoid shame and shameful exposure. So shame sensitive practice is a kind of way to organize services so that shame lens is used, so that shaming is always avoided. So there aren't policies and practices, there isn't language that's shaming things, you know, thinking about, like, just like with trauma-informed approaches, like how is the waiting room laid out? If you're disclosing sensitive things to the receptionist, can other people hear that? You know, stuff like that, like very basic, you know, making people feel sort of psychologically secure and that they're not going to be exposed or vulnerable, psychologically exposed or vulnerable. And then, yeah, so it's about organizing and then practitioners knowing a bit more about shame. So like what all the things we just talked about, how shame is related to power, how it's related to, you know, different intersecting identities can mean you experience shame differently, that will do anything to avoid shame. There's lots of kind of basic, I guess you could call it shame theory, that you could, but it really does, if you start to know, understand this stuff, it really does illuminate the kind of complexities of the experience. And yeah, so that's the idea. And then the organizations are obviously also attuned to the fact that a lot of the things that cause shame are societal and structural. So people, like things that can be prevented, like domestic abuse leads to trauma, you know, all these things that lead to trauma, poverty and social deprivation, all of these things that are not just individuals having agency in the world, but actually they're meshed in these complex structures of social systems and so on. And that we always have to have an eye to, like, activate for positive change. So if the norms that we're living in are unfair, then we should all be doing something to change that. And we all work in different ways. So I work as an academic, that's my kind of way of trying to change the world, but other people might be like activists or writing to their MP or, you know, volunteering in a homeless shelter or whatever it is. But we should all have an eye on those bigger things that are causing that kind of those unfair experiences, those shame, and creating stigma and, you know, disadvantaging people.
Or starting podcasts about it.
Yeah, exactly.
But anonymously because of the shame. So in my experience, there's a real vicious circle with shame. Mm-hmm. You've mentioned embarrassing bodies, which I was obsessed with for about the first series. And then it was just as I was immediately put off it. I don't know what the shift was, mm-hmm. but I remember there was a woman who said that when she had a difficult birth and was left doubly incontinent after a difficult birth. And so ever since had like avoided social occasions, she hadn't worked because of avoiding this. And the doctor on the show said, "And how old is your son now?" And she said he was like 24 or something. Mm-hmm. And she'd spent 24 years avoiding all of those things rather than deal with the shame of seeing a doctor. And there is that bewildering thing that you also mentioned, that if you can't see your doctor, how can you go on TV? But the result was that she had a really minor surgery and it fixed everything and she was great. Yeah. But there is this vicious circle. So we don't tell anybody we hoard because of the shame. So we don't get help. So the hoarding gets worse. So then we go, well, I really can't get help now because my house is in such a worse state. So we don't get help and then things get worse. How can we kind of interrupt that vicious circle?
Yeah. And I think like what you mentioned about this woman, it's like Brené Brown saying shame cannot survive being spoken. And it's like, there's something so cathartic about sharing your shame. So I think that's why people go on that show, because it's like you go from one extreme, which is like complete secrecy, to just being like, you know what, I'm just going to put it out there. And then everyone will know and it'll just not be this big burden anymore. And I don't think we all need to go onto TV. I know there are like reality shows about hoarding, right? Is that right? Yeah. Maybe that's
kind of terrible. Yeah.
Are they? Yeah. I've never seen them, but I've seen ads for them. Maybe Channel 4 has got all those terrible shows. But I think that there's something in between, which is finding your community and trying to like start to chip away at the shame through sharing it, like talking about it, because it like thrives on secrecy and it grows, you know, it's like it just goes into that moist, dark place and multiplies and then becomes the thing that consumes you. And I think it's like shedding that little bit of light on it that and starting to chip away at it. And I think it can only be done, I think, with others, like with, you know, because the fear at the heart of shame, I think, is losing connection to others. And so the antidote to shame is connection to others. I think that you start to build those connections. So then it's like, oh, actually, it's not, you know, like you share the shame and you realize like the world hasn't collapsed and big rock hasn't fallen on top of you and people haven't like run away screaming. And then you're like, oh, it is okay. I can tell a bit more. And I think that's the first step, is just finding the community of others who with whom you can start to be a little bit open about the shame, in particular the shame. I mean, obviously the things you're ashamed about as well, because then you might realize like, oh, I've got the shame, but actually the shame is signaling to me there's something wrong in the world, not something wrong with me. And that's really empowering too, that you, and I think that's why those liberation politics is like all about, yeah, like it's not about converting shame to pride, because I don't think that's possible. I think there is a way to start to feel pride as well. But I think it's like, it's changing the stories, changing the norms out there, that there's nothing to be ashamed. There's nothing wrong. You know, there's nothing flawed or at fault. And like, I think there are those brave people like that man you mentioned who had the throat cancer, who's like, you know what, I'm not going to be ashamed of this. I'm just going to speak it. But like, if you're the only person, that can be very scary, but it can also actually be scary because you might be hounded by others who don't agree, you know, like, and if you do it with a community, then that's a lot safer. And then it also has some, you know, bigger momentum to change the unfair norms, don't you think?
Yeah, I'm thinking about in recent years in this country and around the world, there have been a number of long-term celebrities who have now been found to have abused people.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking of probably the most famous one here is Jimmy Savile, and how the first person to speak out probably wasn't heard or wasn't believed, and maybe the second person wasn't heard and wasn't believed, but there was a strength in when the fifth person and then the 15th person and then the 50th person spoke out. There is a strength in that kind of group voice. Yeah. But then I remember thinking when the first man spoke out about Savile, that must have equally felt really vulnerable, because even though the women were being believed, he must have felt, well, people still might not believe me because I was a boy. And so, but the more we say it, like I talk on this podcast about hoarding and people contact me nearly always private messaging, not publicly, because of shame, because they don't want anybody to know. But the more I chat with those people, the more we all, and I absolutely include myself in that, relax a bit about how awful it is, and maybe start to give ourselves a bit of a break.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And find the things that you can celebrate about it. You know, like it's not just awful and terrible and something, you know, to be ashamed of. But yeah, totally. And I think, I mean, honestly, thinking about like male child, especially childhood or any male sexual abuse, it's so like there's nothing more taboo like that. There's so much silence and secrecy. Men will not speak about these experiences because it's like weak. How did you let that happen to you? You're weak and vulnerable. You know, all of the worst things for masculinity, the way we've unfortunately constructed masculinity in our society. And it's so damaging and so sad. And the more men who can speak openly about it, the more that taboo will lift and the more little boys will be protected. You know, then they'll speak up when it's happening. And that's what we really need to do. And I think that that goes for so many things. Like the more people are open about it, the less damaging we'll become. Yeah, absolutely.
And we can do a lot of work on ourselves, but we are still subject to the judgment of others. If you look at Twitter, when one of those hoarding TV programs is on, you see that a lot of people think it's disgusting. And by extension, we are disgusting. And we can do all kinds of self work, but what can we do when we are shamed by others?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think we can feel very vulnerable to shame when we're already living with shame. Getting out of Twitter. Delete your Twitter account. Step one. Don't look at Twitter, and then don't look at lots of newspapers as well, because they can be very shaming. Yeah, I mean, it's really difficult. I think having the community of others, so when you do have one of these experiences, you can share it immediately with others who can kind of help you realize that there's something wrong with the standards, that rather than something wrong with you, is probably the best way. But then also doing those little bits of work to change the external norms, you know, in whatever ways appropriate and comfortable for you as an individual, because everyone's different. Like, it might be full-on activism, or, you know, could be just writing letters, or it could be doing your little piece of that bigger puzzle to help change things for the better. But yeah, I think community and reaching out to others. And I mean, the internet is so toxic sometimes because of all of that shame that's thrown around and cancel culture and all of that. But like, it's also just so connecting. So you can reach out to, when you've got your community, you can find people all over the world and find, you know, people to share with that. And that is really profound. Whereas before that, we were just alone, weren't we? You know, and sometimes felt very alone, especially if you live in a community that where you don't see anyone who has your identity, or they don't share your values, or it's very conservative and you don't feel you fit in. You know, that can be really hard. So yeah, reaching out to others.
What you were saying about kind of changing the environment that means this is stigmatized makes me want to do. I get slightly frustrated these days with mental health stigma campaigns never going beyond depression and anxiety, which are both terrible conditions that I am absolutely not downplaying, but nobody is destigmatizing schizophrenia and hoarding and borderline personality disorder and well, not nobody, but the big voices in the mental health stigma arenas are not. And I do feel like that has to be an important step.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and I think a lot of those, like, I think the health conditions that have gotten so much understanding about stigma are those that have the most kind of politically active patient groups, you know, like HIV or CFS and ME, you know, like where the
breast
language,
cancer.
Breast cancer, yeah, the language of stigma is just so common to patients who experience it, where with other conditions, people wouldn't even know what stigma means, you know, like, so it's not a word that's used very, and I think that's another reason that like talking about shame is so empowering, is because everyone knows what shame is. As soon as you start talking about shame, people know what you're talking about. But for some people, stigma is like a really academic or technical word.
Yeah. Yeah. Whether they wet themselves in front of the class when they were seven, or whether it's something they've lived with their whole life because they've been subject to racism as the only black kid in a white village.
Yeah.
We can all relate to it on some level.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And I think we know, and then the pain of it, we know what it is to feel shame. And the pain of that, so that it's very connecting, actually. And I think that's why, like, when we do this work with professionals, I've been doing shame competence training with professionals, and it's like getting professionals to connect to their shame, because it's not just like it's like with trauma, there's often the thing was like, well, our clients or service users have experienced trauma, but we haven't. But shame is like, you have experienced shame too, and you're part of a shame dynamic. If someone comes into you in a shame state, you're going to be interacting with that through your own shame. And it's like getting connected to your own shame is it's so leveling, so empathizing, you know, like we're all human beings who want to be loved and want to feel connection. That's it. It's the bottom line. And if we recognize that, and that shame plays a big role in how we experience that on a day-to-day basis, that is profound, you know. Really profound.
Thank you so much. That's been so interesting. I will link to your trauma and shame article and any other links on my website.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Do you want to be a de-hoarding darling? You can be now at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/darling. If you love the podcast and want a bit extra, you can finally sign up to subscribe. Members will get an exclusive monthly post with an additional top tip, some podcast and music recommendations, and a personal update from me about how things are going. Find out the full details at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/darling. So my top tip this week is from the Daily Pep podcast with the lovely Meg Kissack, and something that maybe you just need to hear today. Have a listen.
But here's something that I'm experimenting with lately that I really want to encourage you to try out for yourself. And that's actually putting yourself on the to-do list in the first place. So many of our to-do lists are full to the brim of things that we need to do for other people, things that other people have asked us to do, and generally other people's agendas. And my friend, it is up to us to make sure that our name appears on that list. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that this is easy, and I'm not saying that from time to time you won't fall off that list. But if you're not on the list in the first place, then the chances of success of doing things for yourself are even lower. So have a look at your to-do list or whatever you use to manage the different things that you need to do in your life. And just see if you're on there. And if you are not, this is not an excuse to berate yourself. Instead, get curious about why you're not, and also think about what you would like to be on there.
So I will link to that podcast in the show notes, and do take that advice on board. Okay, thank you for listening, and I will speak to you next time. Thank you for listening to the Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with That Hoarder podcast. You can find more online at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk. You can find me on Twitter at That Hoarder and on Facebook at Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with That Hoarder. To find out more about how you can support the podcast and the overall project, go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/support and do subscribe to the podcast to make sure you don't miss any future episodes. There may be links in this podcast that earn me money. This doesn't come at any extra cost to you if you ever make a purchase through the links, and it helps to support the future of the podcast. I'm not really interesting.
Yes, you are.
Now on Broadway, An Enemy of the People is a New York Times critic's pick. Jeremy Strong is one of the great actors of his generation, hails the Chicago Tribune in a performance the Wall Street Journal praises as powerfully affecting and bitterly funny. Michael Imperioli sets off sparks, cheers the Hollywood Reporter. Victoria Pedretti is luminous, raves variety. From director Sam Gold and playwright Amy Herzog, An Enemy of the People is urgent, electrifying, and haunting, declares USA Today. An Enemy of the People on Broadway through June 16th only.